James, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. It's always a pleasure to be here, and I'm sorry about last week.
Oh, those things happen. I figure you maybe have been off to that conference that they were having, that big conference. So anyway, I'm glad we have you with us this week. That's the important thing. Anyway, let's get your view on what's taking place today as far as the economy is concerned. We see all sorts of conflicting information here. We're told that, oh my goodness, it's wonderful, the unemployment rate is down. Of course, there are fewer people working than there were before, but the unemployment rate is down. And that's because, of course, they don't count you if you just aren't looking for work. So many people have simply given up looking for work, that the unemployment rate is dropping even though more and more people aren't working. We live in a world gone mad.
That's one way to put it, certainly. And I think the latest numbers are something in the range of 110 million working-age Americans who are not employed, and yet we are still being told that this is some sort of economic recovery or a jobless recovery, whatever that actually means. And, of course, all of this, really, as we've talked about before, is just part of the statistical illusions that are created and woven by the people who have the ability to do that in the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the other offices that compile and crunch these numbers to try to convince people that the economy is okay. Because, of course, so much of this is about perception and is about whether or not people will be willing to spend and invest their money in the stock market and continue along with that illusion and delusion, which is really what's holding up the U.S. dollar and most of the other currencies in the world besides at this point.
Well, certainly the stock market is really doing great. It gets up higher and higher and higher. And apparently a lot of the corporations are really making pretty good money. They're just not investing it. The banks are making good money. They're not lending it. Basically, it's almost as if they were designing this whole economic contraction. Do you ever have that feeling?
I certainly do. And again, we can put numbers to that, in fact, by taking a look at the velocity of money, which is a stat that is kept up, for example, by the St. Louis Fed and others that release this. And it shows that the velocity of money in the United States has dropped to 60-year lows. In fact, it has never been quite as low as it is now. And for people who don't know, basically that means the money that is in circulation is not changing hands as fast as it has at any time in the past 60 years. So this is a situation that creates a sort of a logjam in the economy. And this is precisely why, even with skyrocketing amounts of money in the economy that's being pumped in through these QE programs, this money is not causing the type of inflation we would expect. It's because this money is not circulating. The banks are not lending it out. It is not being spent. People are paying off debt. So this money is not getting around in the economy, and that's why we haven't seen the inflation taking off, and that's why, in fact, we even see deflationary pressures.
And basically, because we're seeing, the government is having to borrow over $1 trillion every year, and so they can send out the food stamps, so that they can send out their Social Security checks, so they can send out their Social Security disability payments. I think there's almost 9 million Americans on Social Security disability, including all, in addition to those on regular Social Security. And basically, if you don't want to work, you just say, I'm disabled, and give you Social Security disability. Almost 49 million, I think 48.8 million people on food stamps today. How long can you continue borrowing money to simply reward people for not working? We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is James Corbett, who writes, certainly an editorial for the International Forecaster, and of course has his own economic advisory service. And James is simply talking about certainly one of the reasons we don't see the inflation with all the money they're creating out of nothing and pouring into the economy is because the velocity of the money is certainly limited. Would you like to explain to our listeners again, this is a new group of listeners now, who did not hear your previous explanation, what is the velocity of money? What does it have to do with the fact that when you have a low velocity, you do not get the inflation you would ordinarily expect when you're creating all sorts of money out of nothing?
Well, the velocity of money, it basically refers to how often the same dollars are changing hands within an economy. So if there's a lot of economic activity taking place, then the dollars that are in circulation will be circulating faster and changing hands more often as more and more transactions are facilitated with that money. But if there is lower velocity of money, if the velocity of money is going down, that means that the economy is not as robust. It's contracting in some way because there is not a lot of economic activity taking place. Those dollars are being parked more in bank accounts or even being extinguished by people who are paying off debt. So that leads to a lowering velocity of money, which means that even if there are more dollars out there, they are not circulating around, they're not changing hands. And since the definition of inflation is more paper dollars chasing fewer goods, well, if those dollars aren't chasing goods, then they're not actually contributing to inflation. If they're just sitting in a bank account or if they're not being lent out by the banks, then they're not really contributing in any significant sense to inflation. That's why we've seen such an incredible jump in the actual money supply over the past few years, but we have not seen the type of inflation you would expect to see from that jump. And this is down to a number of things, but of course one of them is just the psychology of the people out there who understand that we're going through an extremely dangerous economic time and are unwilling to take on the type of debt that they were in previous years. And since the entire system really does depend on ever-increasing debt bubbles, this is really something that's destabilizing to the entire global economy.
And basically, of course, what we seem to see be seeing the Chinese economy contracting. We seem to see the European economy contracting, even to some extent, even Germany, the powerhouse of Europe, is having difficulty at times. But here in the United States, certainly, we are not producing as much as we have in the past. And the whole world seems to be sliding into a recession. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I was just simply saying that the Chinese economy seems to be contracting. The Japanese economy seems to be contracting, so that's why they're simply doing everything they can to lower the value of their currency, destroy the value of the Japanese yen so that they're good to be more competitive on the world market. But this can set off a series of competitions between various countries, actually each one trying to destroy the value of their currency. And as this happens, of course, we get into more and more problems. We certainly see the economy in Europe contracting, and even to an extent the economy in the United States contracting. Basically, what is your take on where are we headed? Are we going to be moving into a recession? Are we already in a recession? Are they concealing that fact because they're using phony inflation figures to make it look like we are not in a recession? What are your impressions, James?
Well, I think we certainly can't base our impression of whether or not we're in recession based on those phony cooked numbers, because as we've said so many times, they really are so completely fudged at this point that it's difficult to take them seriously. So I think people would out there on the street would be in a better position to really gauge whether or not the economy is contracting or not simply by taking a look around them. And when we look at, for example, the retail sector, we can see that the wheels are falling off in a lot of different ways, and a lot of different businesses are contracting and cutting jobs and cutting and closing branches. So that's certainly a sign of actual economic activity, more so than whatever phony numbers are coming out of Wall Street and the financial sector of the economy, which of course is not the productive sector of the economy. But I think when we look at the bigger stage and what's happening around the globe, of course, I'm here in Japan, where over the past couple of weeks, we've seen the new Bank of Japan governor take over, Haruhiko Kuroda. And he has started the announcements and the change in policy that we've been expecting for a while here with the Bank of Japan, with their own version of quantitative easing, basically copying what the Federal Reserve is doing or trying their own version of it. And we've seen what that's starting to do to the Japanese economy. In the past few days, the Japanese yen has been depreciated another couple of percent against the U.S. dollar. And as a result, the Japanese stock market has gone up. And this is, of course, exactly what was planned. This is what they're hoping to do. And I believe this is what they're attempting to do with the entire quantitative easing program. But we've seen some interesting wrenches in that works that might suggest that this might not be a smooth process, including the fact that it looks like there have been some wild variations in Japanese government bonds during the past week or so. We've seen some big moves down and up in bond yields, which suggests that this is not a process that's being exactly carefully managed in every degree of detail. And of course, if the Japanese government loses control of those bond yields, and if they start spiking through the roof, for example, that would mean that the quantitative easing is not working as planned here in the Japanese economy. But there's a lot of different ways to look at this in terms of the quantitative easing that's going on. But I think one person had a very interesting take that I'll just point people's attention to. There's James Gruber, who wrote an article called Protecting Yourself from Japanese Insanity. And that's been posted widely online, including places like Zero Hedge. But he talked at great length about the quantitative easing that's going on and what's really behind it and what's really going to be a result of it. And the long story short, he outlines there's four main different methods of economic outcome that we could see from this era of quantitative easing. And as we've talked about here on the program before, not all of the outcomes of this is necessarily that hyperinflationary death spiral that some people have been predicting for a long time. There are lots of different ways that this can play out. And if people don't recognize that, they may get caught in an investment strategy that puts all of their eggs in one basket or another without really contemplating that there could be other ways that this economic collapse that we're looking for could occur.
Well, basically, of course, it would sound, at least in Japan, as if they're destroying the value of the currency, adding a great deal of more money to the economy, and that drives down the value of the life savings of the individual. Now, that stimulates the economy, in other words, makes your goods, Japanese products, more competitive in the world market. But in the long run, won't it simply act to steal the value of what people have worked their whole life for and saved for their retirement?
It certainly will, and in fact, it already is, I'm sure, starting to have an effect on people with fixed incomes and people who have been saving in Japanese government bonds, for example, which is most of the Japanese population, as we've already seen several percentage point loss of the yen in just the last couple of months, and we're expecting, of course, much more. But even more so than simply that aspect of it, there's another aspect to the devaluation of the yen which will really affect the Japanese economy, and that's the fact that basically Japan has been able to sustain its unbelievable debt levels, 245% of debt to GDP ratio, because they have had basically a permanent trade surplus for the last several decades. And unfortunately, that it has already come to an end in the past year or so because of rising fuel prices. And of course, now Japan is importing even more fuel than ever because of the shutdown of the nuclear reactors here. So this is a precarious scenario, and it's only made worse by the falling yen, because the more the yen falls, the higher these fuel imports cost. So whatever gains are made on the international markets for Japanese exporters, I think they will be substantially offset by the rising fuel prices, which is already affecting every aspect of the Japanese economy. And it looks like that squeeze is only going to increase. So it looks like they might just be shooting off their own foot with this gun of quantitative easing here, and without really thinking through the consequences.
Now, are they really in the process then of shutting down the nuclear reactors over there, so that even not just Fukushima, but all the others will be eventually phased out in the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, they in the past 2 years, they have basically taken all but two of the country's nuclear reactors offline for servicing, regularly scheduled maintenance and checks and things like that. But in that process, they haven't been turning them back on when they've been taking them offline for that type of servicing. So right now, the country only has two nuclear reactors functioning out of, I believe, 52 across the country. So it is, and there was a brief period last year where the country was completely nuclear free for a short while. So it is definitely a huge difference to Japan. And obviously, this shortfall is being made up in the short term by huge amounts of fuel imports. And again, that is causing trade deficits for the first time in decades here in Japan, sustained trade deficits, which is going to really affect the Japanese government's ability to finance its own debt at a certain point.
Now, are you burning coal? Are you burning oil? Are you burning natural gas?
All of the above, although LNG, liquid natural gas, is the biggest import or biggest part of that import equation. There has been in recent weeks the promising sign of potential offshore natural gas deposits being mined, so-called fire ice, and I can't remember, I believe it's methane hydrates, are being tapped for the first time as a potential fuel source here, but that's still an untested technology at this point. They're still just sort of putting that through the experimental phase. So it hasn't obviously started to affect the Japanese economy yet, but if they are able to use those offshore deposits, it could drastically change the situation here and in fact make Japan a lot less vulnerable to those fuel import prices. But until that happens, it's still very much a nation that depends for so much of its existence on imports that the devaluation is not the unmitigated good that the Bank of Japan wants to believe that it is.
Well, is the standard of living at all beginning to fall at all in Japan, or is it still a good, strong standard of living over there?
Well, it's difficult to say because it has been the Japanese economy has been in basically complete stagnation for two decades, and so I think we've seen just sort of a gradual deterioration. I've lived here for 9 years now, and I've heard all the stories of during the bubble economy, the types of incredible excesses that basically everyone was living through as the entire economy was lifted, and to contrast that with the way people live now, I think. Well, more and more people are living quite frugally, and this is just something that's become, I think, ingrained into the Japanese psyche. So at this point, I think a lot of people are already in that kind of bunker mentality. So until we start to see the massive hits to people's long-term savings with the Japanese government bonds, for example, until we start to see those types of massive changes taking place, I'm not sure we'll see a drastic change in people's lifestyle because people are already paring back and living as frugally as possible.
Well, apparently the same thing is certainly happening in the southern part of Europe, certainly in the Mediterranean countries, certainly in Spain and Portugal and Greece, and certainly in Italy. Apparently they are really beginning to feel the austerity there, but even my understanding is that even the dynamic economy of Germany is beginning to slow. Is there any truth to that?
I'm not sure of the latest stats on Germany, but I certainly can back up that the southern part of Europe is going through just incredible turmoil right now. And actually, one of the latest signs that we've seen of that is new reports coming out of Lisbon that the Portuguese government was actually mulling the possibility of paying their workers in T-bills, in treasuries, which would have been an incredibly interesting move, because basically instead of cutting people's wages in order to finance their unsupportable debt levels, they would have been paying them in treasuries, thus basically making them finance the debt. So either way, they would win in that case. So a pretty major development there. They haven't done it yet, but they have at least been thinking about that possibility.
And I really think that people out there listening to this must understand there's an organized effort to bring austerity to the world. This is not happening by accident. I think it's coordinated, which is why certainly our banks are not lending, why our major corporations have lots of money, but they're not putting it out. It's almost as if there was some sort of coordinated effort to bring austerity to the world. What if you have any question, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-2295. Our guest is James Corbett, and we'll tell you a little later how you can get to his writings. Always fascinating. Again, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-2295. Well, James, certainly, did you attend this big conference they had last week?
As a matter of fact, I didn't. So I don't even have anything of that sort to report. But I have, of course, been keeping my eye on what's going on, and it has been a very interesting week here in Japan. There's been some, as I say, some huge ups and downs in the bonds, which has definitely contributed to some instability here. And I think people are starting to see what this new era of the new Bank of Japan governor is going to be like.
Well, of course, basically, of course, I have always looked upon Japan as a surrogate of the United States. Certainly, we have over 35,000 troops stationed there. I can't believe that the Japanese government would do anything without the permission of their people who have their troops stationed there. 35,000 American troops. There's a lot of troops to have over there. And all of a sudden, the Japanese can elect their governments. I always sort of wonder if this is an independent action or if this is certainly going along with the worldwide effort, certainly being coordinated here in the United States, to bring austerity to the world. And, of course, behind this seems to be a very carefully crafted plan to bring about a new world financial order. In fact, Joe Biden, our vice president, was talking about that the other day. He wants a new world order. He wants a new world financial order. And I don't think that countries are going to give up their financial sovereignty unless there's some disastrous changes, but I can see them coming here in the United States with almost 49 million Americans on food stamps. We would have long soup lines if we were not having the federal government feeding the people, and certainly, basically, if you are on welfare, you could live very, very well. But it's all being done with the federal government borrowing money here in the United States. I mean, people get housing stipends, they get free medical care, they get food stamps. And basically, of course, if you have a family of four or five, you can live quite well on all the welfare benefits. But the government here in the United States doesn't have the money to finance it, so it's all borrowed money. How long can you continue that sort of thing, James?
As long as people will continue to buy bonds and continue to think of them as safe places to put money, then the governments can continue financing their debts. And again, that's only sustainable if people are basing their perceptions on phony indicators like the rising stock market as indicators of economic health. But it's an interesting phenomenon that is taking place, because as you say, I mean, for example, just look at the food stamp phenomenon in the United States and the fact that getting close to 50% of the households, I mean, we're getting in that range at any rate, are on food stamps. Just staggering amounts of people are being helped and supported by the government and government funding. And I think it's important, as you say, to understand the bigger picture of what's going on here, which is going to be that type of international financial consolidation that's going to take place during this time of upheaval and different currencies and different economies competing and some going up and some going down. It will be easy to get lost and to miss the forest for the trees. So I think we have to keep our eye on that forest, the big picture, which is that international financial order that they're trying to bring in. And this goes back to that question that we often get from people who are wondering, well, why would they, for example, why would they crash the economy on purpose? What would be the point of this? Because even the bigwigs themselves, they have to live in this economy in one way or another as well, and it wouldn't benefit them to be living in a substantially poorer economy, for example. But I think, again, it's important to understand that during these times, wealth is not going to...
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly our guest is James Corbett today. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And basically, James was saying, you know, people are looking to see what's going on. We're seeing a totally manipulated situation. We're seeing the major banks have lots of money. What I call part of the Brotherhood of Darkness, they're not lending it. The major corporations have lots of money. They're not investing. In other words, they're not expanding their industrial base. Why is it that these people who really control the economy are not doing everything they can to stimulate and get us out of this recession that we're in? And so what was your explanation of why they're doing these things, bringing about a worldwide recession? Because this is not happening by accident. I believe it is all contrived. Why are they doing it?
Well, I think we have to understand that in these types of times, wealth is not going to be destroyed. It's either going to be transferred, which is something, for example, that we saw in the 1930s during the Great Depression. We saw the vast amounts of wealth disappear from the American economy, but in reality, it didn't so much disappear as simply transferred to the people who had themselves positioned appropriately for those Great Depression conditions. And in the same way, there will be people who maybe the overall net value of their holdings will decrease, but the relative value of those holdings compared to the rest of the economy will increase. And that, I think, is something to keep people's eye on. Also, another way that wealth can have different effects is that we can look at it as being converted into power, political power, or financial power. And when we look at it in those terms, there will be people, even in a shrinking economy, who will have a greater and greater share of that pie and be able to use their power in political ways. And I think that's something we have to keep in mind as these types of financial crises result in greater amounts of political power in fewer and fewer hands in places like the European Central Bank and the Federal Reserve and these other positions that have worked quietly behind the scenes for many years to shape economies, but are going to be taking front and center stage in the types of long drawn out collapse scenario that we're looking at here. So people have to keep in mind that it's not simply about the number of dollars in people's bank account. It's about what those dollars can actually do and what they actually possess. And I think we're going to see an even greater transfer of wealth in the coming years to the people, the banksters behind the scenes, who have long positioned themselves to ride out exactly what they themselves have brought about.
I don't think we saw an example of that in Cyprus. Basically, we're told that the president of Cyprus, his family had millions of dollars or millions of euros on deposit in the banks, but knowing the crisis was coming and that they were going to start seizing the amount of money in the bank, they simply transferred it out of Cyprus a couple of weeks before the whole system began to collapse. And certainly we're even told that many of the larger financial holders from Russia got a lot of their money out. So who was it everybody lost on? The little guy. The little guy, mom and pops, the pension funds, others. They're in Cyprus, certainly, they may very well take as much as 60%, 40 to 60% of the bank deposits. And I'm sure a lot of that money will never be recovered. Is that your impression?
Oh, I have no doubt about that. And just an interesting further note on the whole Cyprus story, we've found out in the last few days that a former chief executive has had wiping software on his computer, and now there are a number of key documents that are missing from the Bank of Cyprus's records. So maybe investigators will never actually be able to get to the bottom of exactly what went on at that bank. But again, just another interesting little detail, and I think something that shouldn't be too surprising to people who understand that these types of events, like what we saw in Cyprus, are very, very much political insider games that have been manipulated from start to finish, top to bottom, and exactly as the Prime Minister and other key people were able to draw out massive amounts of their money from these banks before the collapse happened, so too can we understand that whatever types of financial manipulations were taking place in the Bank of Cyprus and Laiki Bank, those will never come to the surface because, again, the people at the very top have their fingers on the buttons to be able to destroy whatever incriminating records they want, and this is unfortunately how this type of system of crony financial capitalism really works.
That is the truth. There is a ruling elite, a financial elite that more or less rule everything. And of course, they have been able to buy up the newspapers, so we never really get the truth. We get what they want us to hear, and we believe what they say, either on television or on radio or in the newspapers. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-2295. We've got a George calling from Canada. Hi, George. Are you up in Toronto?
Yes, Dr. Stan, that's right.
Go right ahead. Do you have a question or comment?
Yeah, James was talking about Japan going from a trade surplus, I believe, to a trade deficit. Is that correct?
That is correct.
How do you think that will affect their stock market? Because it's been quite, doing quite well lately.
It has.
Okay, hold that thought, James. I'll answer the question in just a moment. Our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Okay, well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest, of course, is James Corbett. We have George calling in from Canada. And George is asking, well, how is this going to affect the stock market? The stock market seems to be doing fairly well. So how would you respond to that, James?
Well, just to back up the point about the trade deficit, Japan has now reached its longest trade deficit in 30 years and its largest trade deficit ever in the fourth quarter of 2012. So it is something that is starting to affect the economy, but the markets right now are more pricing in the expected increase in Japanese yen that they think are going to be circulating around the economy because of these new policies at the Bank of Japan. So the markets right now are pricing that easy money into the factor, as they think more people will be putting their money into the stock market to try to get the types of returns that they will probably no longer be getting from the Japanese government bonds. So that's, I think, what's affecting the Nikkei, the stock market right now. But it is going to be the type of thing that will have an impact on the economy down the road, as again, you have to pay the piper at some point for the depreciating yen and the rising import prices. So I think once that starts to actually affect the economy, we'll start to see how that will be priced in by the markets. But right now, I think markets are just basing their irrational exuberance on the devaluing yen, which has a quicker effect on markets than the long-term effects of rising fuel imports, for example.
And I think basically, George, people are desperate. They want to do something to preserve the purchasing power of their money. And so if they kept it in the bond market, the bond market will probably drop because of the destruction of the value of the currency. So then the interest rates will go up. And that will begin to increase the impact upon the economy as a whole. People then, of course, putting their money in the stock market, getting out of bonds into the stock market. But how long will that be going up? Certainly, I would not be overly optimistic. I would not necessarily be thinking about investing in the stock market in Japan. Would you at this time, James, or what are your thoughts?
Oh, certainly not. No, for myself, at any rate, I'm still investing in precious metals as the hedge against what's coming. And again, that's part of that article that I was citing earlier, Protecting Yourself from Japanese Insanity, where it talked about the different scenarios, and precious metals do form an important part of any investing portfolio, regardless.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly our guest is James Corbett. We had George calling from Canada, who is asking about investing in the Japanese stock market. Certainly, James is saying that certainly everything is being done to lower the value of the currency, to expand the money supply, in an effort to drive down the value of the currency to make their exports certainly more palatable, to be able to sell more cars because they'll be worth less because the value of the yen is worth less. And so basically, why, of course, more and more people then are getting out of the bonds in Japan. The average Japanese are getting into the stock market, and it's booming. But, of course, the question is how long? Any other questions, George?
Well, would James be investing in any of the stock markets around the world?
Personally, not. but then again, I am not an investment advisor, so again, I don't tell people what to do with their money. But personally, I'm not interested in the stock markets. There certainly is money to be made, as I've said, in this economy, and there will be ups and downs, and there will be places for people to make their money in the stock markets. Just personally, I don't trust it, and also I don't want to be helping to fund the corporations that themselves are such an integral part of the financial and political new world order that they're trying to birth here, and I don't want to be funding that with my money. So basically, that's something that I wouldn't be participating in, even if it did look like it was a sure thing.
George, if you are a very, very astute investor, why, certainly I know some people who can, and they invest and they cover everything with shorts, and they can make money, but they're in and out, they're day traders. They make money in the stock market. That's never been my forte. I'm not smart enough to do it. But if you are, certainly, fine. If you're not a professional, don't get into this market because it'll kill you. Okay, George, anything else before we let you go?
No, very good. Thank you, Dr. Stan. God bless.
And you too. Bye-bye. Okay, before we go on, we've got Mark calling from Oregon. We've got Bruce in Michigan. And again, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-2295. But before we get to our callers, James, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get your writings in the International Forecaster and how they can get the information that you put out as a not as a financial advisor, but just as an observer of what's going on, because I know you have your own newsletter. So how can people get in touch with you? And then we'll get to our callers, first Mark and then Bruce. And then if you're out there, remember 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. How can people get the Forecaster, Bruce? James.
Well, the International Forecaster goes out twice a week. It's about 40 pages long, and it covers matters political, social, economic, financial, and otherwise. And people can get that every Wednesday and Saturday when it goes out. And one way to get an introductory copy would be to go to the website, theinternationalforecaster.com. If you go to theinternationalforecaster.com, you can get an introductory free sample issue. And if you like it, then you can subscribe right there on the website, theinternationalforecaster.com. Or for more information, you can write into the postal address, P.O. Box 7752, Winter Haven, Florida, 33883. That's P.O. Box 7752, Winter Haven, Florida, 33883. And if people are interested in my own work, you can go to CorbettReport.com. As you mentioned, I do have my own subscriber newsletter that includes my International Forecaster editorial, as well as some other recommended reading and viewing and discounts on my DVDs and other materials. And also, once a month, I have a subscriber-only video at the beginning of the month, so people can sign up there at CorbettReport.com.
All right, fine. Well, let's go then to Mark, who's calling us from Oregon. Again, our number 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And hi, Mark, do you have a question or comment?
Yeah, hi, Dr. Stan and James Corbett. Great to speak with you. And I just wanted to mention, by the way, James, at least in my opinion, you're just doing a tremendous job in filling in that gap that Bob Chapman left when he passed on, and we all appreciate you.
Well, thank you so much for that. It really does mean a lot, because I know just how important Bob was to so many people. I heard from so many people after he passed away, and it's truly a tragic loss that we suffered. So I'm just going to attempt to do what I can, but those are two big shoes to be filled by someone like me, I think.
Yes, sir. And James, you've just been discussing what happened in Cyprus, and I have one question about that, and I have one other question about the future of this type of activity spreading to other countries. In Cyprus, I've, to the best of my memory, I've heard it both ways. That is, that actually checking and savings deposits were affected, and I've heard that it was not included with checking and savings, but actually it applied to pension funds and other bank holdings for people that was affected. Do you have a firm idea of which is which, James?
Now that you mention it, I cannot say definitively. My impression was that it was all deposits that were affected, but I'm not sure if that did apply to pension funds and other things as well, so I will have to look into that.
But basically, what I had heard, Mark, was that a lot of the pension funds had their money deposited in there. Now, of course, pension funds ordinarily would be invested in bonds or stocks or certainly in corporations. But some of their money, maybe 25-30%, might be just held in cash. They could have gotten trapped there. I'd heard that. Whether that's accurate or not, all I know is what I read in the newspapers. Anything else, Mark?
Yes, sir. James, as far as this activity moving into other countries in the fairly near future, I've heard one financial forecaster say that Canada is next on the list for actual absconding of funds by the bankers. Now, at the same time, I've also heard that it's soon coming to America, but that Canada will be the next in line. Do you have any word on this?
Yes. Well, Canada just put out their 2013 budget, the 2013 Economic Action Plan from the Conservative Party that's in power right now in the Canadian Parliament. And that budget actually includes wording that basically makes that Cyprus-style bail-in a part of the wording of the actual budget. In the event of in the unlikely event of a bank collapse of some sort, they're basically putting this into the wording of the act itself. So basically, it's sort of formalizing that bail-in regime where they take a portion of the depositors' assets to recapitalize banks that have become unstable. So it's already being hardwired into law in Canada, which is why people are taking a look at that example. And I think we would be foolish to believe that in the event of some sort of major bank destabilization in the United States or anywhere else, that this wouldn't be something that at the very least would be contemplated, if not actually used.
Mark, I think you have to understand that this whole thing that you're seeing, this whole scenario is all being manipulated in my estimation. And basically, why are they doing this? Why are they, as they contract the economies throughout the world, why are they creating the problems and the crises? Because I think they want a new world order, a one world government, a one world financial system, a one world religion. If you listen to our programs, that's a recurrent theme, but that's exactly what they want. Well, how are you ever going to talk people into going to a one world financial system? You got to have a big crisis, and a lot of people got to lose a lot of money, and then they're going to say, we need financial stability. Well, I mean, basically, all these people have been impoverished, and we need to help the people. We need to give them stability, and that's what the one world financial system is. I think, this is my impression, this is what it's all about, and certainly Joe Biden, Vice President Joe Biden, subversive traitor Joe Biden, has recently come out in favor saying what we need is a new world order and a new world financial system, at least. I know he said the new world order, and I've been told he said a new world financial system. Anything else, Mark?
Well, only Dr. Stan, I couldn't agree with you more. I think you hit every nail on the head in what you just said, and it should be obvious to anyone who will look into it a little bit that that's the truth. And just thank you, gentlemen, for all your great work. Really appreciate you.
God bless, and get those people up there in Oregon listening, will you?
I'll give it a shot.
Thanks so much, bye-bye. Let's go to Bruce, calling us from Michigan. And again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-2295 here in the Central Coast of California. Before we go to Bruce, though, James, would you have anything to comment on what I said? Because you don't have to agree with me. I'll have you on, because basically the whole idea is to get your ideas rather than mine. But what do you think of that? Could it possibly be this whole thing is being brought about because they want to get this new world financial system in?
Oh, absolutely. I have no doubt about that. That's exactly my take on the situation. I do believe that they're working concertedly towards this new world order that we've heard them talking about in various policy speeches for years and years and years now. And of course, that does involve the one world financial system, that involves the one world political order under a one world government, and it does involve some sort of one world religion that can unite the peoples of the planet. And we're seeing that happen on every single front right now. And it's, well, it's really horrible to watch this unfold. But at the very least, if we know where things are going, we can prepare ourselves accordingly, and we can start to resist this in fruitful ways. So I think it's important for people to really square up to what's going on right now.
All right, fine. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-2295. I've never met James, but I certainly I'm amazed how close my thoughts are to his. Bruce, do you have a question or comment? Bruce is calling from Michigan.
Yeah. For a year or so, I've been wondering how a world dictator was to, you know, make currency and bullion even worthless and have something like loyalty to him be the measure of wealth. I over the weekend I heard something that made me think that it could be getting closer. Rush Limbaugh type, he wasn't Rush Limbaugh, but you know, one of those AM guys, said that in quantitative easing, I would like this explained, in the latest quantitative easing, they didn't crank out more paper money. Evidently, the Treasury makes coins, and the Federal Reserve makes paper. Mm-hmm. And oh, by the way, why do we need two? But anyway, in this latest quantitative easing, did they actually crank out more paper, or did they do all this by computer manipulation? Say, you owe this, you don't owe that, just with people.
All right, fine. James, what is it now? Are they actually creating the money, real paper money, or is it simply banking entries, electronic entries, or is a lot of this money that the Fed is using today bank deposits? In other words, big corporations, the major banks, certainly don't want to just be sitting on a lot of money, so they're depositing it from the Fed. Even though they're not getting much interest, at least it's fairly safe there, certainly safer than being in a bond market right at the present time. What about that?
Well, it's extremely important that people understand that what's happening right now is not the creation of money in the sense that we think of money. Certainly not paper bills, certainly not coins. That's not the essence of what's going on right now, and that's why this is not having that inflationary effect, as we've talked about. What is being done, for example, right now in the United States under the Federal Reserve's QE3 and QE4, there are two programs going on right now, one that is buying $45 billion a month of mortgage-backed securities from the banks. So that's really just one of those types of financial sleights of hand that is freeing up room, supposedly, on the bank's balance sheet so that they can feel more comfortable lending money out. But it's not actually creating any money directly in the economy. The other program is to buy $40 billion worth of treasuries every month, which again is a staggering amount of money. But basically, that's just monetization of the debt. So it's just basically supporting the U.S. government's ability to continue printing out or to continue going into debt, basically. Again, that's not actual money that's being created in the economy. So it's important for people to realize that, in fact, in the U.S. economy, only about 5% of the money supply is actual paper money and coins. 95% of it is really just bank debt that's being created when it's loaned out to people, for example, for mortgages or whatever it is that people are borrowing money for. And that type of money is not being affected directly by this quantitative easing.
Oh, does that answer your question, Bruce?
Yeah, I think so. In order for either one, the Treasury or the Federal Reserve, to take precedence, to be united into one organization, wouldn't they have to change the Constitution? I believe the Treasury is in the Constitution and the Federal Reserve is not in the Constitution.
You're absolutely right. Well, most of what's going on today is simply unconstitutional, basically. There's no justification for what they're doing for a central bank. There's no justification for them creating this paper money. If you read the Constitution, the states were to create money that was to be based upon gold and silver. But basically, of course, the people in Washington, D.C. are subversives. They don't believe in America. Their dedication is to the one world government, the one world financial system, the destruction of Christianity, and, of course, this new world religion. That's what it's all about. Hey, we're going to have to let you go a little bit, Bruce. Hey, thanks very much for calling. And let's go to, we have Rick in Tennessee. Hi, Rick. Question or comment?
Dr. Stan, for you and or your guests, you know, it's always this talk about take the money out of the bank. Where would you put it besides the coffee can and hope it doesn't get stolen or burned?
All right, fine. Let's ask James that question because I know what he's going to say. James, Rick is calling and saying, look, what are we going to do with our money? Take it out of the bank? What are we going to do? Put it in a coffee can and hope that it doesn't get burned? What are we going to do with our money?
Well, you know what I'm going to say. I, of course...
I
recommend precious metals as the place to be keeping long-term investments and long-term savings because, again, I think that's the safest harbor for whatever types of financial difficulties that are coming. But it's also important to diversify and to have different asset classes, to have a portion in cash, a portion in bonds, a portion in stocks and equities, a portion in precious metals and other commodities is obviously going to be a safer way to do it than to have large amounts of cash sitting in a bank, especially now that we have the Cyprus example, where if you have over X number of dollars in the bank account, they might just come along and take all of that excess out of there at a moment's notice. So I think it certainly cannot be a safe place to just park all of your money in a bank account and expect that it'll be there 10, 20, or 30 years down the road. And so I think at the very least, people should be thinking about different ways to diversify what they have and not to have all their eggs in one particular basket. But if you had to weight one of those baskets heavier, I would certainly be thinking of precious metals.
I think that's an excellent, excellent reply. Anything else, Rick?
Well, just would he take precious metal, take possession of it, or stock?
Would you take possession of it, or would you just leave it in the bank?
Well, personally, I would take possession. I know that ETFs and stocks and other ways of holding paper gold is popular right now. But I think there should be room for that in any investment portfolio. But I would try to keep as much of it physically with me as I possibly could reasonably do so. And of course, if you're talking about massive amounts of money, you're going to have to put at least some of that, I think, into gold, stocks, etc. But the more that you can, as much as you can reasonably reasonably and safely hold in your possession. Because as we know, there's way, way more paper claims to gold than there is actual gold. So when the piper actually comes due and that bill has to be paid, someone's going to be left holding the bag, and it's going to be the ones who don't actually have the gold in their possession that are going to be holding that bag.
Rick, there's three rules of investing. Diversify, diversify, diversify. God bless. Thanks so much for calling.
God bless you. Thank you.
You're more than welcome. Bye-bye. But don't put everything just into one basket. Put in a whole flock of baskets. Bye-bye. Right now we have Joseph calling from Georgia. Hi, Joseph. Do you have a question or comment?
A comment and a question. You know, like they printed up so much money, you know, paper, and then, they're buying back their own debt. But aren't they sitting on a lot of paper? In other words, like if there's a run on the bank, then they could say we ain't got the money to cover it. You know, and then the other aspect is people keeping money in the bank, a lot of people, it's like they're not too far ahead, so if they just keep enough to cover bills and stash the rest, or, you know, I mean, isn't that the best thing to do as far as any big crisis?
Well, no, I'm sorry. No, what is a good thing to do? What specific?
Not keep much in a bank account. I mean.
All right, fine. But basically, of course, James, Joseph calling from Georgia saying, wouldn't it be just as well not to keep an awful lot of money in your bank account? What would you tell him?
Well, I certainly agree. I mean, I guess it depends on what an awful lot is, and I think everyone would have their own feeling on that. But certainly, for example, in Europe, there's the 10,000 euro deposit insurance on bank accounts there, and it was any deposit over that amount that got taken in Cyprus. So you might want to look into that, for example, with the FDIC in the United States or wherever you might have other bank accounts to look at what the insured deposit level is, and not to go over that, I think, would be a good rule of thumb. But exactly right. No, I think putting too much money into a bank account at this point would be folly. And especially, I think it's important for people to look at the ways that this new financial order can be used to selectively bail out or help banks that are failing or let them perish. And of course, it's not going to be the JP Morgans or the Goldman Sachs that are ever going to go under, no matter what types of financial situation they find themselves in. It's generally going to be the credit unions and the smaller organizations that will be allowed to fail in this way.
And basically, of course, in 2008, we had over 8,000 banks. I think now we've got about 58 or 5,900, somewhere in there. We've lost an awful lot of banks. So just have to be very, very careful. Anything else, Joseph?
Yeah, you know, the economists used to have keep track of the money supply, and wasn't the reason really they printed up so much money, you know, like a lot of retirees would save money, you know, and then make interest off of their whatever investments they had, whether it's CDs or stocks, you know. But I mean, isn't it true that the reason they really printed, one of the reasons they printed up so much money was because they're holding all of the paper money, and then the interest rates is low. So
hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly Joseph is calling from Georgia, and he made a point that certainly they're just creating all this paper money, and it used to be that people, you know, said they had money, then they would invest it, they'd get interest on the money, and that was, of course, when we had a solvent currency. That was the world I grew up in, and then in 1971, they took America off the gold standard, and they've simply been destroying the value of our currency ever since then. Joseph, our money has nothing behind it at all. You may think it does, but it really doesn't. And if you look on the back of the dollar bill, you'll see all sorts of occultic logos there. Understand that we're involved in basically a spiritual battle, and it's being fought on the financial battlefield, and those people who don't understand what's going on, most are going to lose everything they have financially before this is over. Got to let you go. We're out of time. James, parting thought before we let you go.
Well, just to pick up again on what one of the earlier callers was saying, it certainly is not constitutional to have a central bank. That was not part of the Constitution, and it was a big debate that happened amongst the Founding Fathers. So I hope people will take a look at the history of the first Bank of the United States, which was the first incarnation of the central bank that was headed up and spearheaded by Alexander Hamilton, and the debates that he had with people like Jefferson over whether or not the U.S. should have a central bank. That's extremely important for our times to take a look at how that developed and what really resulted from that, because when you start to look into it, you start to realize that basically America was colonized by the Bank of England very quickly and its agents acting here. And I think one of those was the First Bank of the United States, and this entire idea of a central bank, which I think is absolutely anathema to what the spirit of the American Revolution was really about. So I hope people will take a look into that history and arm themselves with knowledge, because that's, I think, the only way forward for people during these really destabilizing times.
We really need to do a program on that. Would you want to cover that next week?
Let's do it.
Okay, God bless. And our guest has been James Corbett. Bye-bye, James. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you.